Okay, so I was just trying to figure out why I don't have much recording space left. It's interesting. I mean, hours and hours and hours, of course, but it's getting chillier. It's November the 1st. This day was Halloween. Not of that in my universe. Which it also means that it's time, typically, for I try to get the monthly report on the Shetland project out before the end of the month. I've been working so much on the actual on the actual work that there was such little time to do the report. So, but after this weekend, sun's gonna be out. We're gonna, you know, the time change is gonna affect things again. It's gonna be nice to in the morning. Pretty dark in the evening, though. Regardless, we'll see how the recordings go. Ago, I found Omeka and said, "Ooh, this might be really, really good for Shetlandic Got Info." So I started going through the process trying to update the computer, you know, make sure we were all up to date on various software. I threw the kernel on, and all of a sudden the computer was successful anymore. Now after you do a new kernel, you have to do a reboot to put the new kernel into place. And it didn't come up. The kernel caused problem. And very well could have, maybe, perhaps, I don't know. Yesterday morning I was sick. It was diuretic, I had diarrhea. And stayed home yesterday. An opportunity to take care of some outstanding home stuff. Oh, and the night before, the lid switch on the washing machine got a little glitchy. So we had to, get that thing kind of jury-rigged up so that it was, so that it worked at all. That got done. I'm grateful. I really didn't want anything to be problematic. But regardless, that got done. The service didn't work. School. I checked out the day before and found out that it was probably a disk controller problem. Probably. Because it looked like nothing was really going badly, you know. It must have been in the power cycle. Oh, the tip of this controller just went completely on us. Yeah. But, I applied for a whole lot of jobs. A lot of them closed today, or yesterday even. And, a lot of them at Indiana University. Just issues, things like that. Anyway, I said, well, let's install Omeka on the computer at home. But if the computer at home only needed an SQL server, it already had PHP and Apache installed, so it was no problem putting those pieces together, rigging it up. I had been, we've been pointing the server at the NMU server. And had to point it back at the home server, which was originally where I'd been pointing when it was just an information placeholder. We put Omeka on, and then I started digging around a little bit. It's like, oh, you know, this isn't really what I want. It was mostly just, a content management system. Rebranded. I hate to say that because I'm sure somebody, a lot of people went through a lot of work. You know, most of its ability is kind of tied to the plugins it has. And, but that was really good. Actually, the thing that brought me on to Omeka was a thing called Scripto, which is a transcription plugin. Really meant to help with, you look at a picture or a scan of writing, a page of writing. OCR software does a crappy job, if it does any job at all, on handwritten stuff, which is mostly what this is dealing with. Then it just gives you the ability to look at the picture and then type what you see and try to make that process a little more automated, a little more pleasant. For work kids, usually give to work study, stuff like that. Research assistant. You want to volunteer out if you possibly can. Anyway. But it's tricky to do because it's not very, not very inspiring at first. I tend to like to put volunteers on the more interesting stuff, and then leave the paid staff to handle what I call gut work, the stuff that just isn't very exciting, but that gets the job done. Sadly, everybody ends up feeling a little volunteerish just because they can always change jobs. Sometimes we think that paid employees are something that we can control, and you go, you can only control them up to a point before they start deciding if this wasn't what they signed on for or what they were hoping for. And sometimes I feel that way a little bit here at Eastern. I am somewhat, I think I'm somewhat in the Cinderella period. They're letting me do a lot of projects. I think it's just Justin feels bad that I wasn't going to take a job, and he kind of talked me into it. It's been an amazing opportunity for me to gain experience that I really wasn't going to gain any other way. So I'm not missing the thing at all. I have a little concern that that ultimately I'm being courted and treated well, and then once I've been in for a certain amount of time, that I'll be put more on to unsavory tasks. But I don't want to get stuck doing. Like, I haven't really talked about the leadership log. It's something that I'm using now that I came up with just a few days ago. Popped into the head, so it wasn't my idea. Hopefully it's great. It has to do with money. You know, I'm sorry, managers, leaders, directors, thought leaders, to translate into some kind of a title. Number one, they do make more money. I don't know exactly why that's true. It's the way our system's been set up, and nobody's really challenged it too seriously. Works for me, I suppose, because I'm hoping to break into this sometime shortly. I have this leadership log because I look at my resume and it just does not speak to leadership at all. I mean, it speaks to the fact that I can pick up stuff. I'm quite confident. But it said very little about paid supervisory experience. Jeff Maurer at work likes to say it's a chicken and egg problem. Catch-22. How on earth are you going to get this vaunted supervisory experience, professional paid supervisory experience, if nobody gives to you unless you've had previous paid supervisory experience? Anyway, so putting a lot of stock in the work I've done. But sure, I started throwing in a lot of church stuff. And some of the concepts that I've picked up and that I use that I think will be useful for saying, hey, I think this guy starts understanding. Because I think that's what ultimately people want to see from a supervisor is understanding of concepts of how, number one, to motivate people, number two, to understand how these systems work and how you deal with them. You know, you don't want people going in there for their whole reason is just to shake things up and to be, frankly, quite embarrassing. Nothing's more conservative by nature than management for just saying we want people that we like. We want people that we want to enjoy spending time with. Philosophically, you know, we want soulmates. It gets lonely. It gets lonely in management because, you know, you don't really want to spend time with your underling. That often creates problems. You do tend to kind of pull together an ivory tower sort of mentality. And you want to be really careful of that, because then your time is chewed up by your friends, the custodian, the people who are three levels below you, coming in and shooting the breeze for 20 minutes. You had drinks before, and you have to understand that as a supervisor, as perhaps even as an executive, boy, is that a nice term, a lot of what you do is networking with people who are either on your same level. Typically, you're trying desperately to network with people who are above you. It becomes that necessary. People need to know who you are and what you've accomplished, so that you might be considered for other possibilities. And these things happen all the time. In those kinds of reaches, different criteria are considered. When you say, "Well, I'd like to look at the resume of such and such CEO," and you go, "He doesn't have a resume. Not one that he's going to let out publicly," because you'll find out very quickly that a lot of his his rise to success has to do with things that don't follow the normal prescribed course, which is mostly just a fairy tale. You work hard, you start at the bottom, you work your way up, and you go, "No, he didn't. They didn't work their way up. They took opportunities. They plowed ahead. They took some interesting risks that worked out." And you see them hopping up by several levels, Yeah, I started the mail room, but then all of a sudden I was some executive secretary. I got a coffee for him. I ran errands for him, and people go, "Oh, well, that's no way to get ahead. That's being a brown nose, or a butt kisser, blah, blah, blah." And you go, but then, a matter of a few years later, that guy's a vice president himself, because he stuck his neck out, and he did some pretty unsavory things to begin with, and he may have earned that person's trust. And that person, there's quite a bit of gravitas to having helped groom and advance somebody that's got possibilities, because that guy has every chance of leapfrogging you, and in gratitude for your help along the way, you may be able to rise with him. It really is kind of a stretch my back, I'll stretch yours sort of a thing. So if that appeared on some resume too often, people would stop going to college. They would start, taking a lot more mailroom jobs. And the economy, frankly, needs a lot of suckers. So it's important that we train up plenty of people and don't really give them tools to rise particularly. But there's a good side to it. You also want people to ride who are self-starters, self-initiators. If you had a class that was about how to become a CEO, success is about how to become a CEO, which I don't think exists, they might talk about it, but trust me, it's going to be the old litany of work hard, take on more responsibility. You know if this is going to take 20 or 30 years, you go, bullcrap! Those CEOs are younger than I am! Does that mean I'm behind? Yes! Everything that they tell you in a resume writing school is a good thing to do to help you get your next job is wrong. The ones that say, oh no, you need to stay in your present job for 3 or 4 years so that you can show that you have stick-to-itiveness. You know, that you're not a job hopper and you go, hey, all I know about successful people is that they tend to job hop quite a bit, especially in the beginning. Anyway, so it doesn't really matter. I don't know how I even got onto that whole subject. I think we were supposed to be talking about Shetlandic.info. Anyway, so. Servers crashed, put on the home server, installed Omeka. Never even got around to putting Scipto on it. Because already it was proving to be a bit of an ivory tower sort of thing. It just ends up being kind of a content management system made to, tweak perhaps to fit the kind of paradigm that a librarian or a museum curator would find fits into their idiom. So worldview. But that it was basically one person or two people basically run this site, and if you give other people access to it at all, it's really low level. It has a little bit of a thing to allow contributors to throw stuff on it. But once that contributor does that, they don't have any access to it anymore. And there's other piece of software that tried to make kind of an offshoot that went to MediaWiki, which is the wiki that runs Wikipedia. And that's where all the collaboration, that's where all the chat and the discussion and stuff like that would happen. And I started thinking about it and saying, you know, I'm going to rely heavily on contributors. You know, everybody besides me, I'm not even sure what the gatekeeper role should be or how much we want to play that. I'm very much a wiki sort of a person. And that's kind of how I approach these kinds of things. You know, just to say, our biggest problem will be getting somebody at all to connect with this project. So then to say, you know, the last thing you want to do is as soon as you get the stuff out and say, hello, thank you, goodbye. You know, we'll do something with this. My whole thing is about individual ownership. When you present something to somebody, when you share something with somebody, you want there to be a little bit more ownership to it. Not so much so that nobody else can get to it. Wiki does a really great job of that. Some people think almost too much of a good job of it. Owners lose control quickly. Now, we want to downplay the whole idea of ownership. basically what a play F is, the raw material, and how that raw material can be used, can be accessed, and how you want to simplify that process. Now, from a management standpoint, I would rather manage it really loosely. I was finding that when I was trying to do some kind of a custom solution, I found myself falling into the traps of being really quite stringent about what certain people are allowed to do, what kind of tests they have to take. You know, if you're not a good transcriptionist, well, we just don't want you. You know, if you don't know how to render the written / type Shetlandic dialect, we need to be careful not to let you particularly try. And it was like, you know what? It said that will kill it more than anything else, than people being too ivory tower about it. And media wiki seemed like a pretty good way of building kind of a community. It's a little bit easier than Wikipedia has, because it's tricky to have a, you know, it ends up being many separate communities coming together. And Wikipedia just ends up being kind of the infrastructure of it. I guess that's where I'm kind of wanting to go too, is that I just want this to be the infrastructure, build up things around it. One doesn't want to get weird about ownership. Because that's very much that cuts down on the collaboration. Each artifact that comes in, each recording, at least in the idiom I think about, each recording needs to get a little bit of a, even if it's just a temporary group around it, we need to get a group around it to accomplish all the goals we'd like to do on it. And I find that my role may need to be more of a sign pointer, cheerleader, I don't know if mentor is a good word for it, you know, it ends up being customer relations more than anything else, the customers being the people that you want to have do work for you, and how you keep them engaged, how you keep encouraging them, how you let them know what amazing things are happening, how you give them rewards and awards for what they're doing. A lot of it has to do with feedback, things like that, making an impression. Early on, that becomes a big thing. You almost have to say that everything's up and going and fantastic and everybody loves it long before you have any sense that that's actually true. You paint the picture of how it's going to be, and you keep throwing it out there and say, look, let's see how exciting that is. When you start figuring out that there's very little happening. So when it comes to contributors and contributions, you want to be careful, especially in the beginning, that you keep people enthused. Hopefully they'll catch fire. Some things never do. This Shetland project is always going to be small. You have to understand, everything's small scale. You're not going to have millions of people involved, ever. Because you're not even going to have thousands. You'll be lucky if you have a few hundred mostly. And how do you handle a group of that size? And that means that you have to do every step. You have to help people along every step. Hopefully they catch the vision. Sometimes it's easy because other people can catch the vision pretty quickly. Sometimes it's hard. I really don't know if it's in this project, if it's going to be anything more than a few dozen people. But you know what? You work with what you have to work with. It doesn't downplay the skills it requires. It doesn't downplay what understanding and experience it provides for going to something else. Now, you know, it's always 5 million times better to have something that goes viral and becomes amazing. You know, that's what everybody wants to see, and that's what everybody's going to react to, for better or worse. And don't think along the lines of going ahead and doing perhaps setting up MediaWiki to do this thing. So we can make things work better. Just as simple as that. Because, you know, is it more of a social thing? In the end, I think that's true. I think it ends up being more of a social thing. I mean, I still want them to have those cool feelings of kind of the intergenerational connection. This one young woman, I forget her name, Dare, dang it, I typed her name enough. She's got a couple of blogs going about what she's doing. She's into textiles. Hey, I used to be a homie father. Textiles are kind of my thing. One of my things. One of the things that we worry about because it's kind of a cottage family sort of industry. Especially the good work. The work for which people will pay real money. The handmade stuff. The more exotic of a pedigree that stuff has, the better it sells. The more you charge for it. If you paint the picture of people working at a loom in their home out on some remote coast of a tiny island chain north of Scotland, well, that just raises value. Of course, you got to be good. That's rule number one. If you're putting out garbage, it doesn't really matter where you do it. You're competing with China. It's obviously machine done, but you're competing with China, and you'll never win. Or Indonesia, or wherever else the garment factories of the world have moved to next. Running to the bottom of the barrel, finding the cheapest labor they can get. So they don't consider running these mills to be very skilled labor at all. But when we come to craftsmanship, well, that's a whole different story. Whole different story. Something that Americans, by and large, really don't have a concept for. And, you know, I'll tell you, in that fashion, I'm a pretty good American. I am horribly cheap. So I think I've gotten a bit of theft of quality. I know Lisa has. So I know Lisa will do very well in a world where it's like, no, I buy this sweater and I wear it every other day. It's wonderful. You know. Clean it very carefully. And this garment should last the majority of your lifetime when the kind of stuff I get, you know, Southeast Asian mill stuff, is it going to last more than a year or so? At best. So, anyway. Oh, this girl, I think her name begins with J. I can't believe I can't, I can't remember it. It's in the letter I sent out. Blog posting, stuff like that. An amazing thing. There's some pretty amazing people who have a sense for, I think, themselves. And want to preserve that sense. And, you know, I'm here to help. And then it's really not so much a technical job, although you require a bit of technical skill to get these things set up and running and to administer them. Luckily, things are getting to the point to where the equipment's much more reliable. You don't have to fight with it so hard. If you keep it rather simple, it'll last a lifetime. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here. It's trying to pull together something along that line. And then it becomes more of a people job. How do you handle this? How do you handle these personalities? Set up some kind of a decision-making process. Although, you know, and you spell it out, but you also leave yourself openings for unforeseen issues. That the community tends to run. And then you always kind of give it the ultimate. Is it going to continue? How is it going to continue? When you've either grown weary of it or tired or you die or something like that, you just try to do something that you feel like you can do long term. I think I can enjoy this for a long term thing. You want to have the kind of position, the kind of power, the kind of resources to let you continue to do that. Right now, I can get server space with a server rack. You know, I can get a spawner rack, an old server, put in it. Lots of spindles, bandwidth tied to it. As long as it's not too daunting, this stuff, you know, this stuff's very doable with the position I'm in now. Now, as I rise, it shouldn't be any more difficult because I can just say, hey, we're going to do this because I run this place. And I'm a believer in personal projects. That these are things that, number one, help with employee retention, and number two, I think it also deals with the employee retention. As long as they don't use too much of their personal time, too much of their professional time, working on a personal project, they're going to anyway. So I say, give them an opportunity with some constraints to make sure that it doesn't get in the way of the business process. and you'll see some amazing things come up. And things that, you know, Eastern Mifflin University has a lot invested in keeping this thing up, makes them look good. I've been trying to get the local anthropology department to be interested in it on any level at all. And it seems a little daunting to try because there's just so beyond sometimes people's mentality about these things. I'm really grateful for my supervisor, Justin. He's open-minded and a very easygoing guy. And it didn't take hardly anything at all to get him up to date or to just include him in an email. And all of a sudden, he was like, yeah, we can contribute that. That'd be cool. How do you want to contribute? It's like, yeah. This is how about the server and the rack space and the bandwidth? And he's like, yeah, sure, why not? It's never going to be a big bandwidth puller. The community being served is small. And of course, as always with these things, only a small percentage of people will participate. Even smaller percentage will be contributors to it. We're trying to, you know, the biggest thing is to lower the threshold of pain required to be a contributor. All they need to do is record it and upload it. And the process begins. You know, inasmuch as people want to digitize this so it's more useful, and we may have to come back with the whole transcript thing. It may be far more interesting just to do a synopsis or something like that. If we can find some people who are possessed enough that they want to do that part, we need to make sure that the facility's there. That was the original idea. But, you know, also be willing and ready to accept other parts of the idea. And say, we're willing to be involved in this. Anyway, so I think it's exciting. I think an adventure is ahead. I just got an email from the gentleman that pretty much is involved with the Nordic Studies Institute out of Lerwick, and Grimisa, perhaps, because that's where the college actually is. It's not in Lerwick, it's in Grimisa, but honestly, I don't think you can tell the difference between them when you pass from one into the other. Except that, let me tell you, I've noticed something. I don't know if it's universal to other places in Europe or if it's just the Scottish Isles. In the United States, there isn't, nobody really knows where cities begin and end. It's mostly a legislative tax thing, and cities are always interested in taxing more people and finding justification for annexing the territory into the city. Always a calculation of how much services cost compared to how much tax revenue you intend to be able to bleed out of these people. Sorry, it makes me sound like sinister folks, but sometimes they are. But in the Scottish Isles, I guess is a good way to refer to all of them that I've done any looking at, Boy, you can tell when a city is. It's obvious. I mean, there's this rolling lawn, and then all of a sudden, boom, here's a city. And I mean, you know, it goes just straight up like a volcanic stack. We're just all of a sudden, and everybody lives on top of each other in these little cities. And of course, in America, we spread out like the plague. I think it has to do with not having a whole lot of land and wanting to preserve, you know, these things are all owned to a certain level, whether it's owned by the government or owned by the queen or owned by one lord or another. And the sections that can be carved out and become towns are rather small. I guess it's the old tradition of those lords having lots and lots of power. Now these lords would, over time, for whatever reason, tax purposes, whatever, end up deeding their stuff over to, you know, some kind of heritage trust, wild land thing, or deed it back to the crown. The crown likes open space and likes proposals for its use and things like that. So, it's all very interesting, very different from what I've grown up with, which is urban, you know, if you talk about urban sprawl, every single place has urban sprawl in New Mexico. A village of 100 people, you have the same problem. You don't know where it starts and where it stops. Everybody has their large ranch-style home with who knows how many acres tied to it. It may be in the city limits or not, or the village limits. It all becomes very tricky. And it was around here, it's a whole lot based on what they had hoped for these villages. That never came to fruition. This is a place that boom happened, you know, around the turn of the century, up till about maybe 1920, was really all these areas, big boom times. The bigger cities continued to grow, in population at least. Smaller places, if they had the fortune of having established a school that has survived, they tend to still exist, at least in name. A whole ton of them were places that were just abandoned. But these used to be communities of some thousands of people. And now they don't have anybody there. It's really an interesting process to watch. It's one that I grew up with and lived with for my whole life. Gone to school in dying little towns. Taught school to dying little towns. School. Things like that. And it's very, very interesting. Anyway, so yes, we find that these initiatives, although they sound like IT, pure IT projects, build it and they will come sort of thing. Boy, talk about a fantasy. If you build it, they won't come. Unless you bring them, kicking and screaming, or entice them with candy. That's really the way the things kind of get done. People have busy lives. Either you are you are handling something that a lot of people have wanted done for a long time, but nobody had ever gotten around to actually doing it. Social media is an interesting little beast. I think it fits into the category of, you know, there's something that people really wanted. And that there was really no reasonable technology to do it until, you know, until the internet and big servers became capable of it. You have to understand, the big servers in the early 80s, mid-80s, were much less capable, both storage and processing power, than what your normal kid has come from in the 90s. And it's just gone up exponentially past that. You know, we now deal with terabyte issues. It's not even hard. You can go down to your local office supply store and buy a terabyte or two or three for under $100, which is amazing because 20 years ago, a lifetime in computer parlance, you'd pay several thousand dollars for 5 megabytes, which now isn't even a measurement that we can find anywhere. The term mega hasn't been used in computer speak for 10 years, ever since our processors broke through the 1 gigabit barrier. We had already had larger memory stores. We'd already had gigabytes for a while in memory. And in hard disk storage, although it all came around the same time, breaking that gigabyte barrier. Storage has broken the terabyte barrier. I can't say processing speed has. We seem to have run into some kind of barrier there. We tend to put more cores on them. You know, each individual computer might have several processors in it. They're all the same die, so it looks the same on the inside, but, you know, physically. But, you know, most computers now have at least 4 processors in them. Although, I gotta tell you, our software has not kept that pace at all. Most of our software can't utilize multiple processors on any level at all. It works okay for servers because you can put different threads on different processors, spread out the load that way. It works great for servers. It's perfectly useless for desktop machines, but it's all gone that way. It's all about marketing. You know, your typical desktop box today competes and beats out a server farm, a very expensive server farm of 10 years ago. And people say, oh, no, that can't possibly be true. And go, yes, it is. You have more drive space than those guys have. You have more storage. You've got more memory to play with. That's almost a guarantee. And you've got the add extra thing of that memory is now almost inherent to the box, to the operating system that you use. That memory is parceled out to individual processing tasks as needed, which you could never do at a server farm particularly. That was one of the downsides of it. You know, 2 or 3 servers might be heavily loaded and straining, but then you'd have other servers that just sat there and languished that weren't doing anything but using electricity. Sorry for the technical throwback. Because it's not really about that particular. Now it's much more about what are you doing with these resources? How are you? You know, it ends up being marketing, which I never thought that I had much of a purchase for. I sold regular advertising once upon a time. What a hideous job. I don't claim it anywhere, because I just don't think it's really that useful to me. But you know what? Some of the concepts I learned from that may end up being a bigger part of my life than I ever thought they would be. Because it really is. It's about people. It's about going out, it's about being encouraging, it's about being a mentor. I think it has a lot to do with opening up people's minds to the possibilities and the things that they want, things that they hope for. And I tend to look at it from a life cycle standpoint. The things that your 12-year-old kid wants doesn't bear a ton of resemblance to what your 80-year-old great-grandmother wants to do, who has a load of time on her hands, but yet no, you know, society wants nothing from her except for her to disappear and stop costing society money. We don't like to speak of it like that. Nobody wants to look at it in those terms. That's how it feels, I would imagine. I've got to put myself in their shoes. Their slippers, maybe. And if this is a wonderful way to engage them into something, that it might be interesting to them. That they record this stuff. I want their 16-year-old kids to help them. I can tell that I'm behind. A lot more is going on than I'm accustomed to seeing. A lot more activity. I'm about 10 minutes behind, I think. So, and that's kind of how I see it, is that I think we're going to have predominantly older people doing transcriptions and stuff like that, because they've got time. Yeah, I think it's interesting to them. Especially since they are the experts in dialect, perhaps even in writing. And we're going to find that useful again. And that's exciting, I think. That would be exciting to me as an older person if I looked and I said, you know what? Society just passed me by. I don't know anything about this social media garbage. I don't know, you know. Computer scanners. And, I don't know. Makes people wonder. And so, yeah, the kids take care of the recording part of it, the shaky hand. And people who just don't want to get involved in this stuff can do. Thank goodness our keyboards are patterned after typewriters that they are familiar with. Or many of them are. You know, especially women. There's more older women than there are men. Who, many of them, when the transition from agriculture or fishing happened, when that occurred, all of a sudden, you know, women took other jobs, nursing, stenography, typing, more of the secretarial roles. And there seemed to be a lot of that needed. I don't know how much of that's true in Shetland. You know, these things tended to happen in more interesting rates than that. Agriculture and fishing survived much longer there than on the mainland, I think. And, younger people think more of the past than of the present and the future. The present is kind of scary. The future even more so, perhaps. They may be longing for death, you never know. This thing may help them get a purpose for continuing to live. To say, I need to do this. This is something that requires me. You know, my daughter can't do this. My grandchildren can't do this. They just don't have the stuff. They've been busy learning standard English. Getting all good on the jobs and the careers, the technologies of today. And this gives them something to do that is very much about the past. So all of a sudden, the skills that they have, the knowledge, most of the memories that they have, all of a sudden become very, very, very interesting. And we start putting value back into them. And the fun part is, their grandkids can get involved in it. After they're done transcribing it into dialect type, you know, the lady string and stuff like that, the kids can translate into standard English for it. I found it really interesting. Now, you have to understand, Mormons have this weird thing about family history. And it's a commandment for us to do this. So we've got kind of a built-in need, sometimes born of guilt in my case, to be involved in this kind of stuff. So are you a slave to guilt by doing some of this? That's a wonderful thing, you know. Here's the opportunity to go out, you know. It doesn't bother me that probably the first kid just to go catch on to where our LDS kids don't want to go out and do these kind of projects because it counts as family history, I think, in the big view of things. In Heavenly Father's log book. But the thing that we're also not taking into account, which people might have problems seeing, is the whole spirit of Elijah thing. That this isn't just a Mormon thing done out of guilt because we're commanded to do it. It isn't just a thing for old people to do because they have nothing better to do. And they find themselves more and more interested in the past because that's about where they spent most of their life. And where most of their energy came from was from in the past. There's also this intrinsic need, you know. Women have childbirth. Men have the need to feel like they're accomplishing and providing. And Elijah puts into the soul of the current generation this incredible need to connect with parents, grandparents, children, and grandchildren. It's just there. And if we can give them authentic ways to do this, you know, it fills some deep need. And some of the fracturedness of modern times is that we are told more and more by leaders by those who give us advice that specifying what's important. It's mostly economic. It has to do with making money for whatever variety of reasons those come into play. And and we're often encouraged to ignore other things. We tend to look at it as a virtue, you know. Oh, you people just want to play around and have fun, and you know, the highest purposes are to put aside childish things and become some kind of working machine. You know, productivity, more efficiency. And that doesn't speak to the soul at all. It may speak to the mind on some level. And so, yeah, you see people dropping out of society. You see boys shooting up schools, which for young people is the primary venue of, you know, telling kids what they should be doing. And apparently we're not speaking to the soul very well, because we're seeing some really broken people running around and doing horrendous things and then killing themselves after they do it. You know? And so people say, oh, such a tragedy, we need to get guns out there. No, we need to analyze what goes on in school. And we shouldn't be unprepared to either make drastic changes in schools or just to a large extent, to eliminate them. If we find that they're just soul-sucking institutions, I think everybody has some kind of thing on there. It's just that certain level of our economy can't cope with it. That becomes the problem. It's the coping that's the problem. If schools teach you anything at all, it teaches you how to cope with stuff that you can't control. Now, although that might be really, really useful to an employer later on in life who wants to pretty much run your existence. It does take care of other things. The school teachers seem to think that they should pretty much run your life. And that's sad. You know, it speaks to the soul. So this is something that we do that is going to be a little bit off, a little bit interesting, because it takes care of needs that I think, at least in America, I'm not speaking for other places, what I've observed and where I've come from, American schools are pretty homogeneous. The only thing that makes a small school, and everybody likes to put their kids in small schools if they can cut it at all, is because there's just not enough teachers to enforce the kind of soul-sucking that a large school can accomplish through the economic scale. That's one of the most heartless things you can do to somebody, is to put them into the equation of economics of scale. That's where we get human resources. This one place I just applied to, I forget what it was called, but it was even worse. I think they actually had people down to units. Now, I'm accustomed to jobs being, you know, evaluated as how much of an 8-hour day is needed to accomplish this job, and that is rendered as an FTE, a full-time equivalent. And if it doesn't quite get to a 1.0 FTE, you know, it's a part-time job with all the wonderful things that happen when you have a full-time job. You know, no benefits, nothing like that. You don't have to pay people as well, because it's not expected this to be able to provide a living. anyway, so. I think that's why they changed the software, because I think it needs all to change in attitude. If you put the software in there that doesn't encourage people to participate, you're not going to have much participation. There's only a few people that will fight an interface to the point to where they will, stay very engaged. Have to come back at them, thank them profusely, give them up other opportunities to participate, encourage more input. And to respect that input when it comes. That's probably a bad side to wikiness. I came up with another methodology back in 2002, summer 2002, that's the spring. So it was just made for collecting stuff with the intent that it never gets gotten rid of. The whole point of wikiness is that it's self-editing, in that other people come and they fix things that are wrong in what you're saying. And my point is, there's something legitimate to be said about hanging on to those things that you may have considered to be wrong. It's all about starting something. If you edit it, you save the edit. And, although people may go to a newer version that is done a certain way, that older, I call them products, so that older product remains viable. And the biggest thing outside of this huge storage facility is just pretty much taking everything. It would save differences. It would almost be kind of a difference machine for spacing. I don't know how really logical that is anymore, given the fact that space just continues to outstrip any need to curtail things. The actual scheme might not be very important, but the concept of it, I think, which says that you're encouraged to do an edit or something, but you don't destroy the old thing. In essence, it's just make a copy of it, make your edits on that, and then people can choose to point toward one thing or point toward another thing. But the old things aren't lost. And Wiki isn't very amenable to that, particularly, to that scheme. Because people always say, you've got tons of dead weight, that's terrible. And you go, well, a archaeologist or an anthropologist nightmare, living nightmare, the one that they wake up to every day of their lives, is that something will be lost. Something, you know. Now, we always try to scope things by if they're important or not, but it's always tricky to figure out what's important or not. Historians, too. Things are lost. It used to be that it was just kind of a byproduct of the process of having to rebuild things, that all things would by their nature be lost. Now it's a planned and managed loss of things. And you hate to see it happen. I don't know if there's any real intelligent way to keep that from happening. But that was kind of what this whole system was supposed to do. So I have a problem with wikis for that. That there is a tendency to want to forward some kind of agenda through, more through the process of destruction than the process of adding things. Now, the technology is not inherent to do that. People have to behave. Sometimes we like to use technology to steer people towards certain behaviors, which is probably okay. I would have to rewrite a lot of things to make it non-destructive. One of the things is that, yes, it will be destructive, because people can only handle so much information. And what becomes exciting and intrinsic, you know, is the stuff that ultimately wins the battle for eyeballs and mind share. And my concept is that, hey, if only five people find it interesting, I feel that's a value. At least those five people. So we need to make reasonable accommodation with the stuff that they like, they can have access to. If only long enough, they can copy it and put it into their own personal little storage, their own personal computer, for instance, thumb drive, whatever, so they can hang on to it. It's fine if this stuff ends up being a conduit toward making those kinds of things possible. Huge publicly accessible repository, you know it's not going to last anymore. You know, it's not going to be forever. Nothing is. Things deteriorate. Interest wanes. And, you know, take for instance a museum, you know. You only got so much display space. Everybody would love to have a museum. Well, not everybody. Museum curators would love to have a multi-dimensional museum where anytime they wanted to, they could open up new space. Computers were amazing in that you could have the illusion of that fact so much more readily and so much more inexpensively than trying to physically build more display space. A computer can do that. That's amazing. It's great. And you want to encourage that stuff. And I can see, you know, and I'm not a great unification person. I'm not saying, oh, we're going to just wiki and put everything on. We're going to try to answer every single person's needs with this one paradigm. And you go, no. That's foolishness. going to go, you end up having several tours, whether they're virtual, whether they're real, doing different things, run by different people using different paradigms, you know, very much. It ends up being that way. If you think there's going to be one huge unification database one day, I would find that world to be very limiting and somewhat cacophony. And I just don't like that. We need a world big enough and mostly unrestrained enough to allow more things. Thing, I'm starting to feel like I like Wiki for the fact that it can be most media Wiki might be really good in that there's the whole editing function. You know, anything that you see happening, Wikipedia has its underlay in its media Wiki. And that's exciting. That we can make use of that. Over here. Good morning.